This is URN.
The Film Show Breakdown.
Hello everyone and welcome back to The Film Show. Today we have another countdown. We're doing another list special, and today I think it's going to be a big one because we're doing directors, and we're going to split it into two sections. We're going to do the objectively the best directors working today, and because they're so close in their talent, and it's kind of hard to judge, and there's so many different ways you could judge this, I think we've decided to do it in alphabetical order. But for the second section is where things are going to get very interesting, because then is when we are going to do our favourite all-time directors, and we're going to count down from fifth to first. Who's joining me today in this endeavour, starting with Joseph?
Oh, good afternoon.
Isaac?
Good afternoon.
And hello, Ben.
Hello.
How's it going, guys?
Yeah, nothing bad.
Yeah, so we weren't able to record, unfortunately, yesterday because I was busy. But we're here today.
We are indeed.
Better late than never.
And it sort of gives us a bit more time. We have a bit more freedom on this episode. I'm hoping it's going to be a good one. Now, do you think I've explained the rules well enough? Is there all I need to clarify?
Maybe not to us, but for our audience, maybe so.
Yeah.
I think it'll make more sense as we go through. So our first part, because our show is split into two halves, we are going to be doing, of course, like I said, the best directors working today. And I've tried to clarify it by they had to have released a film in the past 5 years and they have to have an upcoming project. So they can be inactive for a while, but they have to have an upcoming project as well.
I got worried then for a second. Because they haven't released one in the last 5 years, but it's fine. They've got an upcoming project this year. It's fine.
Same. Actually, yeah.
I've got to reword this list. Who am I going to put back in? It's fine.
I've sort of cheated on one of mine as well. It's fine. Hopefully, I'm not out of the loop with something. Like, I'm hoping I don't mention one, and it turns out you guys are like, did you not miss the announcement?
Yeah.
did you not hear it? Just yesterday, they said they're retiring.
Yeah. And so it's sort of honourable mentions, or
I'll start with an. Oh, I will say I watched the trailer we talked about last week, the Pete Davidson film.
Yeah,
that trailer has started popping up everywhere for me. We talked about it a bit on news last week. Honestly, I don't have much opinion of Pete Davidson, if I'm even getting the name right. But that does actually genuinely look like a decent film.
It looks good. I mean, I'm a sucker for that kind of film anyway. And I feel like what I was saying last week is that Pete Davidson's become sort of like an accidental sort of household name just by his relationship with Ariana Grande.
Drama, yeah.
It's sort of like he's been like misrepresented in media. And I think this is a good opportunity to sort of like say who he is, how he is, and that he is actually a very talented comedian.
So, yeah, well, I'll keep my eye out for that. Is there any other new releases before we move on?
No, nothing's been released, is it?
True.
Bit difficult at the moment.
Okay, so for best directors working today, I want to shout out. Oh, I'm going to say the name wrong. Alejandro Iñárritu. Alejandro Iñárritu, director of Revenant and Birdman, very recently, extremely successful at the Oscars and critically in general. But yeah, that's the first shout out I want to give, and then the Coen brothers as well, because they've made some of my favorite films. But was Hail Caesar really Hail the Caesar. Most recent one?
No, it was the Ballad of Buster
Scruggs. Oh, of course, the Netflix movie. I had mixed feelings on the Netflix movie, and it helps. It doesn't help that you still have a mix of stories, so you can't help but have mixed feelings on some of them. But it was definitely a decent project for them to work on, and I admire them for doing something different. I think I'll start at the top of my list, then we'll go one at a time. We'll do honourable mentions on the top of each of our lists.
All right.
And first up, alphabetical order. Best directors working today. Alfonso Cuarón is my first pick. Oh, wow, no dispute on that, wow. I just want to get something right before I mess up when I'm trying to praise his filmography. With his early work, we're talking about Children of Men, and one of my favourite like family films growing up is obviously Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. It's not really what he's best known for today, but I always appreciated him breathing new life into the series, like breathing his own vision into the series. And recently, of course, he did Roma in 2018. And he's like, I think I haven't seen Gravity, and I'm not that interested.
Not a big fan of Gravity, but his work is fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It looks amazing. Like, first 20 minutes is phenomenal. Like, in terms of that tracking shot at the beginning and how it actually looks like you're in space. But the screenplay is so dire. It's so boring to watch.
It was a good. I saw it in IMAX, and it was a pretty good experience, actually.
I think I don't know where you saw it, Joseph, but it felt like when I watched it, it felt like one of those scenes that you can only really appreciate, at least appreciate his work as a director on it, if you're seeing it on the big screen.
Absolutely, both on the big screen, both times.
But it was really good on the big screen. Not sure what his upcoming projects are, but he's. I'm looking forward to what he does next. Like,
he's doing some TV work soon. I mean, he's producing a couple of films, but he's directing a TV show, I think, called Ascension, which is a miniseries. And
what is that about?
I think I think it's back in Mexico, but that's probably why it hasn't.
I'm already guessing there's sort of like a religious angle to it, that sort of thing.
Possibly. Possibly. Yeah. Information on it, yeah, but you can sort of see that's what he's got coming up.
To be fair, it could also be about space. You never know. He's worked on Gravity. He might have a taste for it now.
And Children of Men.
That's why he's on my list as well. I think he's one of the most versatile filmmakers working today. You mentioned Gravity. You mentioned Roma.
Oh, is he at the top of your alphabetically? Is he at the top?
Yeah.
Oh, Ben, do you want to talk about Alfonso Cuarón and talk about your honorable mentions?
Yeah, I can. So honorable mention. Do you want me to just list all of them or just one?
Oh yeah, go for it.
So honorable mentions for me for best filmmakers working today. I have Bong Joon-ho, of course. David Fincher. I got Guillermo del Toro, Paul Thomas Anderson, and Paul Palkowski. Yeah, those are some of my favorite filmmakers, not just some of the best, but I have a deep admiration for all of them. And with Alfonso Cuarón, I think he is one of the most versatile filmmakers, because he's able to make, whether it's Y Tu Mama Tambien, which is more of a road film meets coming of age, and I think that's one of his more understated and underrated works. But I think it's amazing. I think he's also able to do deeply personal, introspective films like Roma, which is probably my favorite of his. And he's able to do things like Gravity as well. So I think his range of filmmaking ability is amazing. He's definitely my favorite from that sort of like the three amigos of cinema, as they're called.
Would you like to clarify who that is?
So yeah, Guillermo del Toro, Alejandro Iñárritu, and Alfonso Cuarón, sort of known as the three amigos of cinema right now.
Best director winners out of the last seven as well.
Indeed, all three coming from Mexico as well. So, but I think I relate to his films a little bit more than Iñárritu and del Toro. So yeah, he's on my list for sure.
I would also like to shout out Paul Thomas Anderson. That's very good. And a last minute change, which I think is very obvious, but as you were talking, I bumped someone down to shout out that was in the top five, which was Martin Scorsese, has just been bumped down to top five working today. Has been bumped down to shout out. And I'll explain a bit more when we get down there. But Joseph, who's at the top of your list and what's your honourable mentions?
So a few honourable mentions. I'm going with Clint Eastwood, just because the sheer amount of work he makes at such an old age is ridiculous. Martin Scorsese, as you said before, he's a legendary director, but I think he's too inconsistent at the moment.
In terms of working today.
Yeah. Steven Spielberg, same as Scorsese with that, respect as well. Paul Thomas Anderson doesn't really make particularly enjoyable films, but he's a master filmmaker. And Richard Linklater as well. It's just just because, again, inconsistency, and because he had such a high with Boyhood that he can't really live up to that since. So that's why I think he's just in honourable mentions rather than current directors. So my first one up for alphabetical is Barry Jenkins. We talked before the show how you can't really include him because he's only made the three films, but I think what he's demonstrated so far in his career is that he's capable of directing a brilliant film no matter what it is. Moonlight is one of the masterpieces of the past decade. I think everyone knows that. The kind of style that he brought to that kind of film really elevated to the degree of the critical reception it received. And with If Beale Street Could Talk, I wasn't a massive fan. I know a lot of people hold it in really high regard. I wasn't a big fan because I sort of knew that style from Moonlight, so nothing really surprised me, and I wasn't really a big fan of the story. It didn't really hook me in. But I think what he showed in terms of his directorial style in that is that he's still capable of doing such an incredible job behind the camera, even if it's like a story that doesn't necessarily work all the time. I think he is someone that I would trust with pretty much any project to do a fantastic job.
Do you know
I think
if he's working on anything at the moment?
I'm not too sure. I'm sure.
I know. He was doing an adaptation. He was about to do an adaptation of the... For Amazon, he was doing an adaptation of the book The Underground Railroad. And that was... I think he said it was like near close to completed in terms of filming, but they had to shut down production due to the pandemic.
Yeah, just adding to what... Joseph said that he's also one of my favorite filmmakers, and I know you've not seen Medicine for Melancholy, but I'd probably recommend that out of his three films, because I think that's what he does with that film essentially. I mean, it almost feels like a before Sunrise or Linklater's films, but he does it really well, and I'll definitely recommend that.
With what we were specifically tasked with doing with this, in terms of best filmmakers working today, I think he really defines this kind of era of independent filmmakers moving into digital filmmaking with the same style of past years that were available to him, but also being taken advantage of modern technology and camera work and stuff like that, which is very modern. So it's a real modern filmmaker for me.
Indeed. That's present as well in Medicine, because I think he's able to... His camera work in that is amazing, but I'm more impressed by his writing on that. I mean, he's an amazing writer. His play for Moonlight is one of the best that I've read in a while. And same for Medicine, I think. What he's able to do with essentially two characters, the dialogue is very gripping. So I'd recommend that.
All right. Fantastic. Isaac, you've been very quiet. You're leading up. Are you gonna shock the world?
No, I didn't know I had to write honorable mentions. And,
is there any off top of your head?
Similar to ones you guys said, like Pavlovsky for Ida and Cold War. What else? Maybe James Gray. Like, I've seen four of his films, and they're all solid. But again, I think everyone knows. I think Lost City is a masterpiece, so I have to put it there. Let me think. Anybody else? Scorsese for similar reasons. I think I'm one of the only people who actually really likes Silence. Bourne and Dove is more modern work. That was like close to being like top 10, more, even top 5 favorite Scorsese films until the ending.
That's interesting.
Yeah, like I love the first 2.5 hours basically until the last 15 minutes, I was really invested. But the problem was, personally for me, for Silence, was that it spent all this like time slowly brewing and boiling to this point, and then it rushes a bunch of Andrew Garfield's character's life, like his whole adult life and his old age, like in the last 15 minutes. And I was like, I'd rather that be half, like at least like another half hour. I could have watched a three and a half hour film on that story, but Oh well, it's still a great film, and I highly recommend it. Yeah, so can I just jump right into my top five?
Yeah, of course. Well, say who's at the top of your top five?
Oh, yeah, so I'm doing alphabetical order as well. I'm just going to put in Paul Thomas Anderson. You just can't beat him. You know, he's one of the
alphabetical order?
Alphabetical order, yeah.
Oh, you're going from last name?
Sorry?
You're going for alphabetical in last name? By last name?
No, I'm doing it by first name. So A to Z.
Okay, and Paul Thomas Anderson's at the top?
Yeah. He's not the best, even though it's one of my favorites. But yeah, pretty much. I think I love him. Or I think I really like his films. Like you guys like his work, but I think he is like one of the modern masters of cinema. I mean, I think he's like maybe one of the best, if not the best, American filmmaker working. And what's interesting, I thought about this. He hasn't made a film set in the present day since Punch Drunk Love. So There'll Be Blood, The Master, Inherent Vice, Phantom Thread are all period pieces, and he's only made three films set in the present day, which is Hard Eight, Slash Sydney, Magnolia, and Punch Drunk Love. But I think even with that, you know, more focusing on period pieces, is that he really kind of shows sort of a lot of his films are about families, whether that be literal or surrogate, and he kind of shows sort of the pros and the cons, you know, the good, the bad, and ugly of identities and kind of mentalities specific to nations and cultures, specifically American culture or West Coast America. And you can't interpret a lot of his films, whether it's obvious or not. It's a lot about period of transition.
Yeah, yeah. We talked about on the
whether it be turn of the century or the post-war period. But interestingly, if I want to make a quick comparison to what doesn't seem like a close link, who's seen Boogie Nights here?
I have seen Boogie Nights.
I have not.
So do you remember the scene in Boogie Nights where this is sort of, I think, the New Year's Eve party in 1979, sort of the end of the first half of the film, where Burt Reynolds and Philip Baker Hall are talking about, you know, how business will go into the new decade, and Philip Baker Hall's all about using videotape, and Burt Reynolds is all about still using film, and it's like a kind of clash, and that kind of is very integral to the film, especially in the second half. But there's a scene also in Phantom Thread where Reynolds Woodcock, by name Lewis, he's complaining about the change of fashion because he does haute couture. And you know, Sybil, played by Leslie Manville, is talking about people want things that are chic, and he calls that a filthy word. And even though these seem like two very different films, there are two scenes that could be almost like you know, the opposite ends of the same coin. So I think even whether it be different times or places, I think Paul Thompson does have a through line for a lot of his work, and I think it is always really engaging. I think even though his films are a lot like his earlier work is more ensemble driven, like Boogie Nights or Magnolia, I think he's still as good at doing more focused character studies, like from Punch Drunk Love onwards, even if he does have big casts. So I think he does create like some of the most, you know, some of the best characters, you know, since his career. And pretty much like I haven't seen Inherent Vice, but with Boogie Nights, Magnolia, Punch Drunk Love, There'll Be Blood, The Master, Inherent Vice, I would give not Inherent Vice, Phantom Thread, I would give all of those films a 9 out of 10. I think he's never made a truly bad film. All his films have either been, you know, great to like spectacular. So yeah, Paul Thomas Anderson for, you know,
all right, fantastic.
One of the best filmmakers.
And number four for me, I'm still going alphabetical, of course, but it's David Fincher.
Good choice.
His films are so fantastic because the characters themselves feel so real, even though they're in such bizarre situations and obviously such near fantastical situations. Like, he does some of the best crime films going, I'd say, like throughout his entire career. And
The Social Network.
Yeah, I was actually going to mention The Social Network because it is technically a crime film. Like, the framework of it is a lawsuit.
Yeah, and it's, yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah.
But it's a good, like, that's a fantastic example of how it's different kinds of crime, different kinds of characters. Like, all of his characters are flawed in very different ways. And, like, none of them truly get out of the film being fully innocent, I don't think.
Yeah.
It was a fantastic choice to direct The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, by the way.
Yeah.
They've handed him these... he's so trusted by the studios, to be honest. For someone who has such a distinct vision, he's often given films by producers that require a lot of trust, such as The Social Network, which was quite an important film to have to be at the helm of at the time. And it's probably turned into one of the most important films of the past decade, which we have previously discussed.
Yeah.
I'll move on. And Ben, what's your number four pick?
My number four pick in alphabetical order is Christopher Nolan.
Very good.
Probably, probably the most reliable box office director of all time. His films have amassed up to, or if not more than, $4 billion. And I think it's interesting because it's weird to see that sort of filmmaker make that much money, because a lot of his films tend to almost feel experimental, and they tend to deal a lot with, themes that sort of try to distort our nature of meaning, whether it's via time or what we understand as, existential problems. And, I always draw a little comparison to Stanley Kubrick as well in that frame. He's made films like Dark Knight, Inception, Interstellar, Dunkirk, more recently. And he's making a new film called Tenet with Robert Pattinson and John Washington. And I think you almost sort of, with every film that he makes, you sort of know that it's definitely going to make some money, and it's going to leave you thinking afterwards as well. I'm going to go with Christopher Nolan.
It's a good crossover between what studios want, what critics want, and of course what audiences want.
Yeah, for sure. I don't think I don't think there's a director on my list that achieves that better than he does.
Yeah.
I'm going to go with him.
Joseph.
Yeah, I think this will be pretty quick. My second pick is Christopher Nolan as well. it's pretty much the same what Ben's just said, but he has shown more capabilities in recent years to not only just do the high concept ideas with his films, but also with taking, more realistic situations and making them exciting and thrilling. I think Dunkirk is one of the most masterful films made of the last few years. I think it's phenomenal in every respect. And to show his capability of making a blockbuster out of that kind of situation, which was such a horrible tragedy, as well as he's shown with science fiction work or with other ideas that he's put across in his films before, I think shows his real ability as a filmmaker, and he's one of the best around.
Fantastic. Isaac?
I'm going to go for Bong Joon-ho. I think most people know him now for winning Best Director, Best Screenplay, and Best Picture for Parasite, deservedly. But I think his best achievement in his 20-year career is...
Hold on. How does... You put Paul Thomas Anderson first alphabetically?
Yeah, so A to Z.
He's done last names, we've done first names.
You've done it by last name?
Yeah.
That was very confusing. Okay,
that makes more sense. It's
proper way of doing it, yeah, but go ahead.
Oh, yeah, Bong Joon-ho. Yeah, I think in his 20-year career, whether he does films in South Korea or international or sort of more, American based, I think he's similar to Christopher Nolan, gives sort of balances, and so he equally subverts and I think satisfies audience and genre expectations, because he's done a lot of, tread a lot of genres in his career, and they're all like masters of those, but I think he also kind of is very good at satirizing those as well, and I think he's very genre fluid. Like, some of his movies can be one or more different genres, sometimes one scene can be have sort of tonal clashes, which I think is deliberate. And I think underpinning all that, I think he is a very funny filmmaker, even in something that's more dramatic like Snowpiercer, a mix of satire and absurd kind of sense of humor. So I think that's why I kind of latch onto him. I really like, especially with something like Snowpiercer, which something that could seem very cliched, actually is very nuanced, especially in the later stages of the film. Or, Parasite is obviously now such a worldwide success. That's a similar case. So Bong Joon-ho, one of the best filmmakers working today, maybe the best South Korean filmmaker.
Fantastic. Number three for me is Denis Villeneuve. So we've talked about him quite a lot recently, like Arrival. Hold on, let me try and get this right.
Prisoners. Blade Runner 2049.
Absolutely, probably one of my favourite films of the past couple of years. I can't remember. We did our favourite film of 2017. Did I say Blade Runner 2049?
I think you did.
I want to say you did as well.
I would not be surprised. And of course, he's working on the upcoming Dune. So in terms of that slow burn sci-fi, he's really brought something special to that kind of genre. He's brought something that like a mainstream audience can be engaged with as well. I think it was such a fantastic choice to give him the reins of the Blade Runner sequel, because there's not much else. It's not an easy project to give a director, and I think he took it and absolutely ran with it.
You think that's hard? He has to adapt Dune.
Yeah.
That's like near impossible.
That's going to be interesting.
Favorite novel
to see.
As well.
Ben.
It's my turn.
I'm trying to quicken it as we go.
No worries. I'm going to go Damien Chazelle.
Nice.
He's also one of my favorite filmmakers, not just, you know, the best. I think I've seen every feature film of his, including Guy and Madeline on a Park Bench, which is amazing. It's basically La La Land, but in black and white. And I don't think there's a better director ever to fuse jazz and film in the way that he does. And he, you know, there's a scene in La La Land where he talks about the tension in jazz. And you can almost sort of feel that in his films, particularly in Whiplash, you know, changing the narrative as just being a very sort of, you know, elevator music, as he says in La La Land. And it's more frantic than that. And I think that you can see that in La La Land. You can see that in Whiplash as well. You can definitely see it in Guy and Madeline. So I think he's able to do that so well. He's insanely talented. I mean, this is not a film, but even in The Eddy, which is streaming right now on Netflix, the difference between the episodes that he directs and the others, you can see the way he directs jazz numbers. Like there's an intensity to it that is, it's amazing and it's invigorating. And I kind of feel like I'm sounding like Ryan Gosling's character in La La Land going on in that monologue. I like him a lot.
I like to hear that. Go ahead, because I haven't mentioned him on mine. Go ahead, Joseph.
Yeah. I'm going to go for a British filmmaker, Danny Boyle.
That's another one I've missed out on. Yeah.
I mean, he's best known for recently for Word Isn't my favourite at all. Like, Slumdog Millionaire I wasn't a massive fan of. And, of course, the opening ceremony of the 2012 Olympics, which, again, was cool. you know, everyone loved it at the time, but I didn't think it was that great. But I think his more recent films have really shown how great he is in terms of moving on from stuff that he's more known for. So obviously Trainspotting before that. But I think stuff like, if you look at his two more recent works in 127 Hours and Steve Jobs, he's taken two very difficult books to adapt and done them in incredible style and in ways that make them so exciting and so interesting. Yeah. 127 Hours shouldn't be as thrilling as it is. I've read the book for 127 Hours and, you know, it's very much just a guy stuck with his arm in a between two boulders. You know, there's not much to it. But that film is incredible and really smart. And Steve Jobs, the same, you know, coming up straight after how bad the Ashton Kutcher Jobs film was, to come back with this new kind of style, doing it in three separate sections with three different, you know, styles of cinematography as well. I think it's genius, and he's a very underrated character.
What did you think of T2, Trainspotting?
I haven't seen that one.
I've heard mixed things, but there's still like.
Yeah.
He's
one that's hyped up when it gets announced, but by the time it comes out, people aren't bothered anymore.
Yeah. And also, shout out to 28 Days Later. Probably one of the best.
Yeah, that's
probably
my favourite Danny Boyle film.
Isaac.
I'm going to have to put Barry Jenkins. I know you guys have already said, I think I'll try to say something different. The great late Roger Ebert had a phrase, like he called movies like empathy machines. And there's going to be a couple more filmmakers I mention later in this episode, but I think he is like one of the filmmakers where he creates the most empathy. He creates, like, I'm so empathetic to sort of the characters in his films and sort of the stories they're in. I think I'm a bit kind of on the reverse of Joseph, where I liked Moonlight. Like, I didn't love it like most people, but I certainly have a lot of respect for that film. But I think if Bill Street could talk, just personal preference, I thought that film was just spectacular. Like, I was kind of like out of breath after I saw that film. And I think even though his films deal with like really heavy, serious subject matter, whether that be in relation to sort of gender or race or sexuality, you know, politics, economics, class, all these sort of things, which can be very dry and very kind of, you know, unappealing to sort of most audiences. I think the way he does it through these kind of, quote, you could say, love stories, I think, and the way he does portray love and romance in his films are just like some of the best, I think, work. Some of the best like depictions of it in modern times, if not ever. Like, there's a lot of influence of Wong Kar Wai, but you could still, he still has his own character. Like the way he, you know, the way he moves his camera, the way he shoots close-ups, like I love his close-ups, or just like the use of color, his music. Like, it is just so just sweeping for something that is stories that are quite intimate and small scale. And yeah, Barry Jenkins, I highly recommend both Barry Moonlight and If Beale Street Could Talk.
And I think I'll move on to my, oh yeah, so this is interesting. So this is technically number two, but it's alphabetical. And this is the person that knocked off Martin Scorsese. It's because someone mentioned him. It's Guillermo del Toro. So I realised, I did think about him a bit when I was doing the list, but when I thought about it some more, and I thought about Martin Scorsese's recent work, and I'm not really sure what he's doing for upcoming projects. It just didn't feel right to not include Guillermo del Toro, who is very much still in his prime. Like, he recently won for The Shape of Water in 2017. And of course, if we're looking at historical work, how can you not talk about Pan's Labyrinth, the Hellboy films? Like, these both these films which rely so heavily on craft, but are so pleasing to audiences. I think it's such a fantastic mix, and he's got Pinocchio coming soon on Netflix next year. I have no idea what to expect from that.
He also had another film, Nightmare Alley, which was supposed to be released this year or next year, and that's obviously being delayed.
Yeah. Shout out to Guillermo del Toro, who is number two on my list, and we'll go straight over to Ben.
So number two on my list is the person you rudely bumped off, Martin Scorsese.
It's good, so he still gets included.
How dare you? I like Del Toro a lot. I think he's definitely fine being on that list. But I have to go with Martin Scorsese. I think for as long as he continues to make films, I don't think his position is as a top five filmmaker is threatened. A lot of people were talking about, you know, his recent stuff not being as good. I Isaac said, I quite like Silence. I really enjoyed Wolf of Wall Street. But you go back to his previous work, I don't think, there's definitely no filmmaker today with his CV, Raging Bull, Taxi Driver, Goodfellas. These are not just films that are just sort of the best of his time.
Yeah.
Are really some of the best of all time. And some of the themes that he, I mean, if you compare, even it sort of feels like he's still, it's weird to say, but it sort of feels like he's still growing as a filmmaker. Because if you compare Silence and Passion of the Last Temptation of Christ, those are two films that sort of deal with the same subject, but the way he does Silence is it's very different. Like he almost sort of takes a step back from how he did Temptation, which felt very, I don't want to say forced, but it felt like it was very head on. But with Silence, it just felt like he took a different approach in telling almost the same sort of story. I think that's evidence of him still being a very he's still willing to learn, and he's still very inventive. He's not sort of doing the same old stuff. And even with films like Hugo as well, that's a film that a lot of people don't talk about in his resume, but that's one of my favorite Scorsese films. So I think he's still able to do sort of breathtaking work for me anyways. I know, you know, some people think he might have dropped off, but I still think he's amazing. He's making a new film now called Killers of the Flower Moon, with, De Niro
Leo.
Leo DiCaprio. Yes. So, and I look forward to that. I still enjoy his films. So yeah, I'm going to go with him as my, second pick.
Nice one. I'm glad it wasn't left out completely then. And Joseph, number two.
Yeah. Well, it's not my number two because Apple's still.
Yeah.
I'll go with David Fincher. But the thing with Fincher is that I think if you look at his last three projects, they're all ones that shouldn't work. They shouldn't happen. They shouldn't be as good as they are anyway. They have no right to be as good as they are.
The Social Network,
Girl, Dragon Tattoo, and Gone Girl. There's been controversy about all three because of all adaptations. Girl, Dragon Tattoo had previously been a foreign language film. Social Network was just considered the Facebook film and was going to be a failure no matter what. And Gone Girl was a controversial novel. There, it's sort of like it was difficult to live up to the hype of the of when the book came out. But all are fantastic films. Gone Girl, especially, think about it more, is such a really exciting thriller, and it's got so many good twists to it, and Absolutely. Really makes that accessible to so many different audiences. I think it's fantastic. Social Network is one of my favourite films. I've talked about it a lot on the show. My respect for that film. I think it's one of the best written films of all time, and to keep up with Aaron Sorkin's screenplay is a very difficult task, and he does it better than I think any other filmmaker has done before. So I'll go with David Fincher for this one.
Fantastic, Isaac.
Yeah, I'm going to go for a brother duo. It's not the Coen brothers.
Okay.
I'm going to go for the Safdie brothers. So, yeah, so with recent films like Good Time and Uncut Gems, I think these are some of the best crime films in modern years because they echo sort of, you know, the classic New York greats of the 70s and 80s, but they still have their own distinct flavor. Like, they're very claustrophobic and exasperate, you know, they're very close up and very, you know, they're shot on, they're very grainy, like 35 millimeter, like it is very grainy, it's close to 16 millimeter. And sort of this, it's not even just the soundtrack by Daniel Lupton. I think that's how you pronounce his name, like his synth-driven scores. I think it's also their usage of sound design. Like, that is as more intense as their camera, because it's just so in your face. When I think about the best performances of their leads, like Robert Pattinson and Adam Sandler, like, that's the best of their careers, is their films. And I think they are challenging audiences, especially with Uncut Gems being widely accessible on Netflix now for most audiences outside of America. Now in America, they do create quite flawed characters, like pretty much unredeemable and just, you know, really just irresponsible and just terrible people. But they do try and challenge this idea, like, should a protagonist be relatable or should it be, you know, engaging? And I think obviously I don't relate to the leads that Safdie brothers have created, but they are immensely engaging. In fact, in a weird way, they're kind of underdogs in their own tale. So I would highly recommend both Good Time and Uncut Gems, especially if you're a fan of kind of the classic sort of New York crime films of the 70s and 80s.
Fantastic. So, not number one choice. It's alphabetical. And we'll have to rush it a bit. But that's fine, because it's not people's number one choice, probably. So at the bottom of my list, or the top, and I think, honestly, if I was doing it preferential, there'd probably be fifth or fourth, is Quentin Tarantino. Obviously, I have a lot of respect for him as a filmmaker. I really liked Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. But I think, like, I know it's not really fair to hold the time between each film against the director, because, you know, you don't want to rush the artistic vision. Of course, he doesn't have the most regular release schedule. And when you wait for years for a film to come out, there is the upside of it being like, it's more of an event that way. But then I think people are also more inclined to pick it a little bit more, if that makes sense.
It's a double-edged sword,
Yeah. And he's coming towards the end of his career, which is probably the main reason why it'd be lower on the top five, because you got to give someone else the credit for future potential. But yeah, I've pretty much seen all of his films. I have seen all of his films at this point. And he never ceases to impress me with the mixture of style and substance. So yeah, Quentin Tarantino. Ben, what's your number one pick in alphabetical order?
This might come as a bit of a surprise, but I'm going to go Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah.
and I think almost everything that you said, I think is same with Scorsese, really. As long as he keeps working, which I think he is. I mean, he says he's got about one more film in him.
Yeah.
You know, he's made some of my favorite films. You know, Pulp Fiction, of course. Reservoir Dogs, which I think is still sort of underrated. I think not a lot of people think about that when they think of him immediately. And Yeah, I mean, I don't want to say too much more because I think, you know, you've said it all, and I feel like someone else might say his name before this is over. But I really enjoy his work, and I still think he's a reliable filmmaker as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just from a commercial point of view as well, his films would always make money. And it's not what it's about, but, you know, he makes money as well as sort of making very thrilling stories. I think he's an amazing writer. I probably prefer him more as a writer than actually a director, but... Quentin Tarantino.
Fantastic. Joseph?
I'm going to go for another British film filmmaker who directed my favourite film of last year, Sam Mendes. Directed 1917 last year. Absolutely blew me away. That's one of the most, you know, near-perfect films I've seen in a long time. He made one of my favourite debut features of a director I can remember in American Beauty, and he's shown his capabilities with James Bond franchise as well. So he's shown a real range in his films with different genres and different themes and different, you know, nationalities of people. So, I have a lot of respect for him, and I wish he made more films than he actually did. So I'll go with Sam Mendes.
Fantastic, Isaac.
This is going to make Ben happy. I'm going to put for last, but certainly not least, Celine Sylmer.
Yes.
That's what I binge watched this week. I just binge watched all her films. I watched Girlhood on Amazon. I watched Tomboy on BFI, and I watched Waterlies. I just did them all just to be sure. I think she's almost similar to Barry Jenkins, in that she's very empathetic. But, you know, to paraphrase a review I found on Letterboxd, even with her films, that whether it be like A Cool Color Palette or Deals It With Water, like all her films kind of feel on fire. They're very brimming with passion. And I think it's not that she's a great filmmaker, a show with stuff like Girlhood and Portrait of a Lady on Fire, which I do consider a masterpiece. Is that I think she is a very important filmmaker. I don't say that lightly. I think she's a very essential and important filmmaker in the modern era, as seen with, you know, the kind of the debacle of the Caesar Awards and her being snubbed by a lot of major award shows. But definitely the Caesar Awards can go screw themselves. But I think, you know, she shows the importance now, sort of fluidity in terms of maybe sexuality and gender. Sexuality, gender identity, that sort of thing. But this isn't just for like her film set in the present, whether it be, you know, her first three films, which are kind of a loose trilogy. I think also Portrait of a Lady on Fire, which is a period piece, but it is very modern in its narrative and its perspective. And I think the way she kind of champions like newer narratives, you know, this female gaze, you know, she kind of says that Portrait of a Lady on Fire is like her manifesto on the female gaze. But again, it's not dry. It's very kind of, it's a great romance that I think anybody can enjoy. And I don't think her work, or, you know, her as a sort of advocate is iconoclastic to different narratives. I think she just wants to bring equality and balance, which I fully support. And even though her films are very quiet, you know, whether it be the lack of dialogue or whatever, I think all the lack of music, even though she has a great understanding and usage of music in all her films are very silent, but I think they are very powerful, and they're also very political, even if that's not to the forefront. I think they are very politically charged. And I don't say that as an insult or a negative. So yeah, I think she is maybe like one of the most important filmmakers working today. And I think I will look forward to whatever film she makes next after Portrait of a Lady on Fire, which is a masterpiece.